Hello and welcome to Building Insights, brought to you in association with the A. Proctor Group. I'm James Parker, editor of Architects Datafile. And today I'm joined by Ian Fairnington, Technical Director, and James Johnston, Head of Facades at the A. Proctor Group. We are discussing the very current topic of specialist membranes for passive house design. Particularly important as we start to look at creating zero carbon buildings in not only residential, but a range of other sectors. Hi guys, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, James.
How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. So firstly, what is a passive house and why is air tightness important to passive house design? Ian, can I direct that one to you?
Thanks, James. I think the passive house has some great principles of trying to reduce energy usage, improve the energy efficiency in a number of different ways, looking at all different principles, similar to the principles that Proctor used in our HAM principles, which is heat, air, and moisture. So basically the passive house looks at the building holistically and reducing its energy use while making it thermally efficient. Air tightness is very important to reduce the infiltration and exfiltration. You want to reduce the cold air coming in, and also you want to reduce the air that you've heated up escaping. And similarly, that cold air that comes in, you have to heat it up. You don't want to do that. And that's what the passive house principles reduce. Then you've got to keep with the mechanical ventilation, make sure that you've got a healthy environment so the air's moving. So there's a lot of good principles. You're looking at cold bridging as well. Making sure that you're reducing those cold bridges that will reduce thermal efficiency of your envelope. So there's lots of good things in terms of a passive house. And I think sometimes people get a bit scared of them. Sometimes they can look a bit weird. I don't know why. You can't just put a normal pitch roof on some of these passive houses instead of a flat roof with metal cladding. Not that I think that that's a problem. But people get a bit scared of them.
They also have the distribution of windows can be a bit unfamiliar and strange.
That's a very good point, James. The orientation of how you're using the solar energy from outside and gaining that heat has to be coupled with reducing the heat. So there's a paradox with Part L, for example, the thermal efficiency approved document, where you want to reduce the amount of heat going outside, so smaller windows, because windows tend to be a leak, but you also want to increase the solar gain. So one is telling you to have small windows like prison cells, and the other is wanting you to have full gable windows, and you balance that off, and I think passive house does that particularly very well.
It's not just homes, is it?
Very much, James. We've done a school in Perth, and a number of schools, where passive house is actually being utilised to do that. Going back to my school days, it was nice to be by a window, especially depending on what the subject was. But in the summer, it could be overbearing with the heat coming in. And passive house has a really good way of being able to control that with ventilation.
What is the best route to achieve passive house air tightness requirements, and bearing in mind that we need a continuous air barrier to ensure the performance, but also ensure it's a healthy environment? And James, would you be able to give us an insight into that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, achieving passive house air tightness requirements is, as Ian stated already, is a critical aspect of building a passive house. Again, whether that's low-rise resi, whether it's mid-rise, whether it's high-rise, whether it's commercial, whether it's educational, whether it's healthcare, it needs to be designed properly in order to minimize energy consumption for heating and cooling. It's not only about, obviously, loss of heat from the building, It's about making sure that if you need to cool that building, then that air, that cool air, doesn't escape through the building as well in the hotter temperatures, where you get the reverse philosophy in regards to cold to warm, warm to cold. So obviously in the summer, when it's warmer outside, you're getting a cold inside. And obviously that cold will naturally navigate through the envelope of the building out. You lose that energy through the building envelope by having that reverse effect. So as you've already stated, so establishing a continuous air barrier throughout that building envelope is absolutely paramount in order to make sure that that convection doesn't happen.
And that requires a really rigorous approach, doesn't it, from everyone?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So the barrier should encompass the walls, the floors, the roof, around the window reveals, around the door reveals, depending upon what the design is, in order to prevent that air leakage. So common air barrier materials include specialized membranes, tapes, and sealants. So ensuring meticulous construction practices to minimize gaps, cracks, and other potential air leakage points. You need to pay attention to the junctions. Obviously, they're the main concern for all contractors, for all designers, is the fact that the junctions between windows and doors, between the facade and the windows and doors on a high-rise project, it's junctions between the concrete columns and the sheathing board, the concrete column and the soffit, the sheathing board and the soffit, the sheathing board and the slab. So there are your main penetration points. And indeed, talking about penetrations, you're looking at obviously pipework coming through that facade system. So whether it's a low-rise boiler vent system going through that facade, you need to make sure that that area is sealed so that you've got no air leakage coming out through those.
So really change of approach from traditional construction beyond all recognition in some cases, isn't it? In terms of really identifying the smallest penetration points and avoiding them, or rather tackling them.
Yeah. Well, it's about understanding, it's about integration of the manufacturer into the specification, about integration of the manufacturer into the build when it's going on. So making sure that the exacting parameters of installation are being adhered to by the subcontractor in order to make sure that the understanding of how important the membrane is in order to achieve that airtightness line is understood.
I imagine you will do that installation in some cases. Is that right?
Yes, we carry out toolbox talks on site to main contractors, to clients, to the actual installer themselves, obviously predominantly. But then obviously we carry out the site reports intermittently, obviously initially at the beginning of the project, especially if it's the first time utilising material. Then we carry out very early on site reports and then sort of sometimes go back every week in order to make sure that they're starting for the right start point.
But you can have an airtight building and at the same time, vapor can be permeating through that fabric.
Yes, I mean the main area of what we do is obviously looking at the material, which is airtight but vapor permeable. So again, if you're looking at a high-rise project with a concrete frame, you've got a lot of moisture within that concrete frame, especially as predominantly they're cast on site. So you've got a lot of inherent moisture within that concrete frame. If you took the old school route of covering it in EPDM, then all you're doing is putting a barrier on that concrete so that moisture can't exfiltrate through the membrane. It will have to go into the building and dry out through the building itself. But at the end of the day, if you've got that membrane on the outside, the moisture will permeate through that membrane, which will allow it to dry out quicker because you've got more means. Obviously, it will still dry out internally as well, but it will dry out through the outside of the building. If you're putting a control layer on the inside of that line, on the inside line, then that, again, will impede that drying out of the concrete internally. So potentially it will get trapped and create interstitial condensation risk between those layers. So it's best to allow that building to breathe as much as it can do and breathe in regards to vapor permeability as opposed to airtightness, which is, again, a popular misconception in regards to what a breather membrane is.
I think that's a really good point you're making there, James, and it probably emphasises the fact that the membrane, the airtight vapor permeable membrane, is almost a little bit of a game changer in the properties of the product that we are promoting here. Because, yeah, you need breathability, yes, you need airtightness, and then to put it externally on the outside can confuse people at times because people think that airtightness must be on the inside. The development of membranes and constructions can be aligned to rain jackets. So you've got your wetsuits, which would be your EPDM type construction that James talked of on the outside. They were great for keeping the water out, but you would sweat a lot. Cagoules, again, great for keeping the water out.
Vapor's not getting through that, basically.
Exactly. So you want to balance that up, and you've got to look at the whole thing holistically. And that's where Gore-Tex came in well, with breathability and water tightness. So essentially what you're using on the buildings is like a Gore-Tex, using it externally to keep the water out, but allowing the building to breathe at the same time, keeping your air tightness.
For some people, that might sound counterintuitive, that you've got air tightness, but at the same time, vapor is able to transfer through the membrane.
Yeah, that again, it'll be a question that will be asked in training and seminars. Going back to the jacket side of things, you can get water-resistant jackets that are really good for breathability and water holdout. And they're also very good if you're into hill walking and you want wind resistance. So effectively, what you're looking in the air tightness is wind resistance. So it deflects the wind and stopping those drafts coming into the house and also stopping them going out. But with vapor pressure, the vapor can pass through.
Is MVHR a must in a passive house where you're concerned, James? MVHR, for anyone who doesn't know, creates healthy air in a tight building by bringing in the external air, doesn't it?
With a passive house standard, then the air tightness requirement is very, very, very low. So therefore, the proper ventilation system really needs to be looked into by the designer, by the engineer. Mechanical ventilation with heat recovery. It's often an essential component of the building's ventilation strategy, as I mentioned, but it's important to note the specific requirements of passive house certification. They may vary depending upon the country or certifying body. So obviously that's something that needs to be aware of as well. And the primary goal, the backstop requirements for different countries, sometimes, especially in Scandinavia and some of sort of Austria and Switzerland, things like that, are a lot more onerous than our standard ones in the UK. You know, we've still got to make inroads into making more effort in order to do this. In regards to the actual system itself, whether you choose to utilize mechanical, whether you choose to utilize passive, I think this is the crux of this question: is MVHR required? To coin a phrase from my dear friend Ian, it depends, purely due to the fact that, you know, the strategy is what it's about. And that's why you integrate engineers and consultants into this, because you may have a combination of MVHR with passive ventilation. So it's about making sure that whatever strategy you've got in place, it's been designed around the fact that this is your air tightness line. This is what you need to achieve. So you've got pipework, you've got tubes, you've got vents, you've got louvers, you've got all these things penetrating the outside of the property. You need to make sure that the air tightness line is created around those. You need to make sure that MVHR system, all the pipework and ducting, has been installed properly, because poorly installed ductwork can create its own leaks. And so if those joints in those ducts aren't sealed up properly, then you can create air leakage points which are unplanned for. Therefore, your air tightness will be impeded. Every project has to be bespoke. Every project has different requirements, different needs, different occupancy levels. You know, somebody may have a swimming pool in part of the building, which needs to be taken from a different moisture risk. So therefore, you know, that needs to be understood. It needs to be taken into consideration when designing these things.
It's just not necessarily what we do at the moment.
It has been done. You know, we've been part of the first passive house leisure centre down in Exeter. And obviously the passive house was achieved at the end of play, which is great. So it is possible to achieve a passive house in a high risk, moisture loaded environment, because again, the strategies were put in place, the designs were put in place, the knowledge of what the materials are doing, and that the fact that they need to be installed properly was understood by the contractors. The fact is that, you know, we've got to meet targets by 2025. We've got to meet targets by 2030. We've got to meet targets by 2050. And this is the way to do it. from the passive house side of things. To take on board the principles is fair enough, but to fulfill a full passive house criteria is very strenuous.
If we break it down to brass tacks, how many membranes are required just for a rule of thumb in a wall build-up? And could you tell us a bit about the taping side that we hear about and how to mitigate the penetrations that are necessary?
Again, depends upon the build-up that you're looking at. So if you're looking at, if we go back to a traditional, so brick and block with a cavity, ultimately, from that purpose, you wouldn't be utilizing an external breather membrane as such. You'd utilize a VCL, and obviously dependent upon whether you wanted emissivity or if you just wanted a standard VCL in there, then you'd either use a foil-faced or a standard polythene-reinforced VCL. But what we are seeing more often than not now is because the understanding that the cavity board, so your polyisocyanate or phenolic cavity board, has shrinkage through the lifetime of it, and you've got butted up joints within those boards. So taping those junctions of the boards, even if they're cross, you know, overlaid with each other, you've got a 40 mil board underneath and a 60 mil board over the top of that. You tape those junctions in order to negate air leakage, infiltration or exfiltration through those boards. If you move to timber frame, then yes, you've got a VCL internally. Predominantly, it's a foil-faced VCL. And externally, you've got a foil-faced breather membrane. From the high-rise perspective, we're working on two passive house high-rise projects at this moment in time. We have got an internal VCL. We've got a primary air barrier on the face of the sheathing board. And then we've got a secondary air barrier on the face of the external insulation in the cavity behind the rain screen, negating thermal bypass and wind washing. So you've got a ventilated cavity behind that rain screen system, which from a passive house perspective, this is where we see this third membrane coming into the equation, because they want to reduce the effect of cool air passing over the face of the insulation, which could potentially cool that insulation down, which therefore makes it less efficient. But again, from that membrane perspective, you're looking at UV tolerances if you've got an open jointed system in order to make sure that it will stand the test of time in that scenario. It literally comes down to the fact that the manufacturers are integrated into the design. The manufacturers are integrated into the main contractor, subcontractor. They're on site. They're training the guys how to do it in order to make sure that no areas are missed. In regards to penetrations through the membrane, especially when it comes to mispenetrations or where they're trying to detail around ductwork penetrations and brickwork contractors, everybody needs to be monitored. The communication, this is what all businesses are still saying to this day and age, is the fact that communication has to be there. Communication between the trade behind, the trade in front, the trade, anybody penetrating through that system needs to understand what those layers are doing and why they're there. And if they do damage them, if they haven't got the materials in order to repair them, then they speak to somebody on site. No material, no breather membrane is overlaid without being snagged first in each area in order to make sure that that insulation board doesn't cover up a mistake.
So that's discipline at every level, isn't it? Yeah.
When you've got insulation boards, as James just explained, but that foil tape will also trap moisture trying to escape. So the traditional way of putting foil tape on insulation boards has to be looked at differently. Not overcomplicating it, but just making it vapor permeable and obviously sticky. So that's really important. You can solve a problem with an easy fix, but you've got to think it all the way through. So it's all about being able to deal with these things holistically.
And what's the alternative then to a foil tape in that scenario?
Wrap-tight tape is very useful in that application because it's airtight, sticky, and it's vapor permeable, all in one. Some of the insulation manufacturers are using that as a solution in their BBA certificates as well. Just going back to what James said, people have got to speak, and it's not just in isolation. You've got to think, communicate, what are you trying to do and what are we trying to do and what solution can we provide at the same time.
Talking about myths, lastly, there are some around passive house and membranes, and you can get a little bit hidebound if you're not careful, having done it a few times perhaps and thinking this is the orthodox way and we're sticking with it. And if we're talking about airtight membranes on the outside of buildings, is there a myth that we need VCL inside as well. Ian, would you like to comment on that?
It's a great question, James. And as a conspiracy theorist, I love a myth. So yeah, you're absolutely bang on the money. Some people do consider an airtight membrane the vapor control layer, and they can be, and they'd be very useful in that application. But it doesn't have to be. Using the airtight membrane on the outside, it acts as the airtightness, but it's vapor permeable. That doesn't necessarily mean you don't need a vapor control layer on the inside. A vapor control layer is a different function. It's stopping vapor getting into the structure. An airtight membrane is stopping cold air coming in from outside and warm air leaving. So they're different functions.
Doing two different jobs, yeah.
Yeah. But we have this vapor permeable membrane that can be used within the construction because it's what we call vapor neutral or moisture neutral. So you can't put it in the wrong place, like a vapor control layer. If you put that on the outside, it can trap moisture. Going back to your cagoule side of things. By having that membrane on the outside, it's allowing the vapor to escape. It's keeping the building dry and it's airtight as well. So what we see, people tend to think, certainly in the passive house community, they think we're trying to negate the vapor control layer. Now, we can do calculations. In some circumstances, you can negate that, but it all depends. Depends on where the insulation is. Effectively, if you put an insulation between a frame, you really need that vapor control layer on the inside. No matter what you're doing on your wrap type or whatever airtightness level you're doing. If the insulation is placed outside the building, so outside the sheathing, then it's less critical. And it goes back to the technical term, it depends. Depends on the insulation type, the insulation placement. There's a lot of things to be considered, but it is a myth that you don't need a vapor controller. You might not need a vapor controller. It depends. We did some work with UCL, London University. How bad can you install a vapor controller for it still to work? And that's really difficult because that, again, goes back to that, how bad have we got an installation? Really, there's no doubt trying to put a vapor controller on the inside is a better than not trying. Put the vapor controller in, but what you're trying to do is stop the vapor getting into the structure, and your airtight layer is on the outside, so you don't have to worry about your airtightness layer. On the outside, it's a lot easier to do.
You're definitely not absolutist about this, which might be the myth that we're hopefully clearing up now. Wrap-tight, the uptake has been reasonable, has it, in this sector, or is it still fighting the kind of the orthodoxy a little bit?
We've been selling Wrap-tight in the US for probably over 10 years, and it's very popular in the US. We didn't introduce it to the UK because at that time air tightness wasn't critical and people weren't interested, but certainly we're getting a lot more pickup. People are getting better understanding for it in modular as well as high rise. The schools, people are really starting to buy into the principles of what that membrane does.
It's about just highlighting, to coin a phrase, USP. I mean, that's what we're trying to push. And, you know, when you're dealing with a building that's sort of 10, 15, 20 stories high, the wind speed that you get up there is quite severe. And if you're looking at a traditional breather membrane, which has got a couple of bits of tape holding it on, it's not going to stand the test of time during that construction process when it's exposed. You know, the material, the Wrap-tight is watertight to W1, so it maintains that water holdout or water tightness during that construction process before the primary waterproofing materials get put on.
Let's be honest, sometimes projects get put on ice, don't they? They need to stand there.
Exactly. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you know, lockdown was a prime example of the fact that buildings just stopped. Everything just stopped, and you need to have that confidence. The material arrives on site with the membrane still on there. This is an improvement on understanding, only the human understanding of how we need to treat these building envelopes. And it's not the fact that there's a must, you can, you know, definitely get rid of the VCL altogether. I mean, from our perspective, we manufacture VCLs. So why would we stipulate absolutely that you don't need a VCL? The fact is we're optimizing that building envelope. Yeah. We're negating the potential issues that are faced by the reliance on the installation of the VCL. Because that VCL is behind plasterboard, the installation of the VCL may be absolutely perfect, no problem at all. But then you put plasterboard on top of it, two layers of plasterboard on top of it. Then you've got plumbers and electricians coming in, cutting holes through the plasterboard, through the VCL. And with the best will in the world, nobody's got hands that small that can go around the back of that plasterboard and tape all that up. But then you've got homeowners, you've got maintenance work that goes on in that property, which will potentially damage that VCL during its life, as during its service as well. That's not being affected on the outside of the building. So on the outside of the building, you've got this secure, holistic envelope. The works that go onto that external facade will only be done through massive planning. So the attention to detail will be a lot greater from an outside position.
Money-wise, just lastly, you could potentially do your modelling, et cetera, and then you can lose the VCL and you've saved a lot of money on your project.
Well, it's product, it's labour, it's another contractor. It could speed up, obviously, the process of obviously, you know, once the SFS is on, then the plasterboard can go on. But in regards to sort of, again, from a passive house perspective, in regards to air tightness, in regards to getting a check done on your air tightness line, you can look at, once you've got your SFS, from the point of view of infill SFS between concrete column, slab and soffit, you've got your SFS sheathing board, so a cement particle board or calcium silicate board on the face of that. You've got your Raptite on, you've got your windows, doors with your EPDM around. Then you can carry out an interim air tightness test. So you don't need to worry about getting the insulation between the SFS, the VCL on, the plasterboard on, and then carrying out an air tightness test. Because then if there's any issues with the air tightness, to carry out remedial measures are vastly more expensive than if you've just got the SFS sheathing board, Raptite, EPDM, and windows on. Because they're still there, they're still workable, you can go to work on them instantaneously without any problem.
Passive house design isn't necessarily as complex as you may think it is. And there are ways of simplifying it. What we've talked about today is some really important myth qualifying and questioning rather than busting necessarily. And I'm really grateful. So thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks very much for the opportunity, James. It's been good.